Technocracy News and Trends is the authoritative source of information about technocracy on the Internet. I'm Patrick Wood, Editor-in-Chief. Here's the title of this story, Why I Wrote About Reflexive Law in Technocracy Rising 2015, by Patrick Wood. The most misunderstood facet of technocracy is reflexive law. I have asked many lawyers, even constitutional scholars, to explain it to me over the last 11 years, and not one could answer. The legal community is clueless. Perhaps you, as a layperson, can understand why we have lost almost every legal battle in the last 30 years. It's time to restate my case. Reflexive law is not substantive law, case law, or administrative law. Patrick Wood, editor. The central argument made in Technocracy Rising was that reflexive law is not merely one legal theory among many. It is the precise legal system required by technocracy because it replaces substantive law, democratic accountability, and fixed constitutional limits with process-driven governance administered by institutions, experts, corporations, and networked regulators. That identification was correct then, and the intervening years have only made it more obvious. The language of sustainability, stakeholder governance, resilience, innovation, transition finance, and digital modernization has supplied a moral veneer, but the underlying legal mechanism remains the same. Power migrates away from legislatures and electorates towards self-regulating systems that are supervised but rarely constrained by public authority. This is why reflexive law matters so much. It is not just a technical legal doctrine. It is the jurisprudence of managed society. It tells the state not to command directly, but to induce self-adjustment in corporate, financial, environmental, and technological subsystems. It tells regulators not to draw bright-line prohibitions, but to create frameworks, incentives, reporting obligations, and adaptive procedures through which the regulated parties learn to govern themselves. It tells the public that outcomes no longer matter as much as compliance with approved processes. Once that shift occurs, law ceases to be a barrier and becomes a transmission belt. That is why the theory fits technocracy with such precision. Technocracy has always sought rule by calibrated systems rather than by representative institutions. It prefers metrics over morals, administration over politics, and managed adjustment over open contestation. Reflexive law gives that ambition a legal form. It transforms law from a command backed by sovereign authority into a procedural environment in which approved actors internalize policy goals and then certify their own conformity to them. The result is an order in which experts, institutions, and transnational corporations are empowered to set the terms of governance while the population is left to navigate systems it did not design and cannot effectively challenge. The United Nations and its legal theorists saw this utility long ago. Sanford Gaines explicitly described reflexive law as a legal paradigm for sustainable development, arguing that it works by specifying procedures for regulated entities to follow while declining to define a required substantive outcome in advance. That single admission is extraordinarily revealing. Sustainable development, as operationalized through reflexive law, does not chiefly govern by immutable law. It governs by iterative procedure, by mandated consultation, by disclosure, by stakeholder processes, and by institutional adaptation. In other words, it is a legal architecture tailor made for a technocratic order that seeks continuous social steering without the inconvenience of overt political responsibility. This is also where mercantilism enters the picture. Mercantilism is often misremembered as nothing more than state protectionism, bullion hoarding, or imperial trade policy. In reality, it was a system in which politically connected commercial actors received legal privileges, monopoly rights, and financial protections from state power in exchange for helping administer economic empire. It was never simply the state dominating the market. It was the fusion of state authority with privileged private networks. The merchant class did not abolish political sovereignty. It colonized it. The state granted charters, monopolies, armed protection, and monetary favors, while private companies extracted wealth through trade, finance, and colonial control. That is why my friend Martin Erdman's work is so important, and why his influence must be acknowledged. Erdman was my original mentor in cracking technocracy because he helped expose the long historical continuity behind systems that many analysts still treat as separate phenomena. His argument in The Greed for Gold and Glory, 2025, is that mercantilism was never abolished. It was relocated, refined, and internationalized through successive financial centers, culminating in the modern city of London and its offshore satellites. That insight illuminates the whole present moment. Once mercantilism is understood, not as a dead doctrine, but as a mobile operating system of power, reflexive law appears in its proper role, the contemporary legal mechanism that allows mercantilist structures to function under modern conditions. Erdman traces the pattern across Venice, Spain, France, Amsterdam, London, and eventually the Anglo-American financial world, arguing that the extractive mechanism retained its essential shape even as its outward forms changed. The recurring elements were oligarchic control, privatized money creation, monopoly privilege, state-backed enforcement, and ideological narratives that justified unequal access to power. That list should sound familiar because it maps directly onto the architecture of modern technocracy. The names have changed, the rhetoric has changed, and the tools have changed, but the legal political structure is remarkably consistent. The City of London stands at the center of this continuity. Erdman's reviewer describes the Square Mile as a self-governing financial district with ancient charters, its own taxes, its own police, and a constitutional status unlike ordinary democratic jurisdictions. In parallel, commentary on the city's offshore empire characterizes it as a command center for global wealth routing through crown dependencies and associated jurisdictions that operate through special legal arrangements and regulatory latitude. This is not an accidental quirk of British history. It is a living example of semi-autonomous financial sovereignty embedded within, but not fully subject to, the nation state. Here, the connection to reflexive law becomes unmistakable. Reflexive law is regulation of self-regulation. The City of London is the institutionalization of self-regulation at financial scale. Its power lies not only in accumulated capital, but in its ability to shape the norms, procedures, and legal environments through which capital circulates. The city does not merely ask governments for freedom from rules. It asks for a collaborative, process-based, growth-oriented regulatory culture in which regulators and industry jointly construct the conditions of oversight. That is reflexive governance in action. The City of London Corporation's 2025 report, Regulating for Growth, made this orientation explicit. It called for a cultural shift in financial regulation, emphasizing that regulators, government, and industry should align around competitiveness and growth. This is a classic reflexive move. The regulator is no longer a sovereign external authority drawing hard legal boundaries. Instead, the regulator becomes a partner, facilitator, and adaptive supervisor working inside the same procedural ecosystem as the regulated firms. Once regulation is framed this way, the legal system no longer restrains mercantile ambition, it optimizes it. This is how reflexive law has greased the skids for mercantilism. It dissolves the old public-private distinction without ever publicly admitting that it has done so. Under substantive law, monopoly, fraud, conflicted self-dealing, and political favoritism can at least be named and prohibited. Under reflexive governance, these problems are translated into matters of disclosure, risk management, stakeholder engagement, resilience planning, or best practice reporting. The offense is no longer exploitation itself, but failure to follow process. As long as the right procedures are observed, the underlying transfer of power can continue. The genius of this arrangement, from the standpoint of elite institutions, is that it appears modern, humane, and adaptive. It speaks in the language of sustainability rather than empire, inclusion rather than monopoly, innovation rather than enclosure. But the structural logic is the same mercantilist logic that Erdman documented. Privileged financial actors receive legal protection, procedural autonomy, and political access, while the broader society bears the downstream costs. Reflexive law does not create mercantilism out of nothing. It updates mercantilism for an era in which open monopoly charters would provoke public resistance. The move into blockchain ledgers and tokenized assets shows this with exceptional clarity. The Bank of England has stated that it is prioritizing systemic stablecoins, tokenized collateral, and the digital security sandbox as key pillars of the United Kingdom's digital financial future. The sandbox is designed to let firms test issuance, trading, and settlement of securities on distributed ledger systems under a controlled regulatory framework. This is reflexive law translated into digital finance. Rather than the legislature first setting a comprehensive body of fixed rules, public authorities create a bounded experimental zone in which market actors, regulators, and technologists learn together and adapt as they go. The phrase, "learn as we progress," used in connection with the digital security sandbox, should be read as more than harmless technocratic language. It is a succinct summary of reflexive governance. Law is no longer a prior limit. It becomes an iterative accompaniment to financial experimentation. Market infrastructure firms test models, regulators observe, standards emerge through practice, and the entire process is presented as prudent innovation management. Yet the effect is to permit the gradual legalization of new forms of asset control, payment intermediation, and ledger-based ownership before a democratic public has meaningfully understood what is being built. Payment tokenization and asset tokenization are often sold as neutral efficiency upgrades. In practice, they create the technical substrate for an unprecedented merger of financial surveillance, programmable compliance, and asset fractionalization. Regulated stablecoins can become settlement instruments. Tokenized collateral can circulate through wholesale markets. Sovereign debt, private credit, real estate interests, and fund shares can all be represented as ledger entries that move inside tightly governed digital systems. The blockchain ledger is frequently marketed as decentralizing, but under the emerging institutional model, it is better understood as a synchronized record-keeping infrastructure administered by approved intermediaries within approved rule sets. That matters because mercantilism has always depended on privileged control over the channels of exchange. In the older era, those channels were sea lanes, chartered companies, ports, bullion flows, and central banking franchises. In the present era, the channels are payment rails, custody systems, digital identity frameworks, settlement networks, and tokenized asset registries. Whoever writes the rules for those channels possesses mercantilist power, even if the rhetoric is post-national and the branding is technological. Reflexive law is the lubricant that makes this transition possible. Instead of asking whether tokenization should be permitted in a substantive constitutional sense, reflexive governance asks how it should be piloted, supervised, risk assessed, and aligned with innovation goals. Instead of debating whether payment systems should become programmable tools of policy, reflexive governance asks how resilience, interoperability, and compliance guardrails can be optimized. Instead of prohibiting concentration, it manages concentration procedurally. Instead of denying mercantilist privilege, it digitizes mercantilist privilege. This is exactly why the City of London is so important in the story. The city has long served as an incubator for legal and financial arrangements that operate at some remove from ordinary democratic scrutiny. Its offshore networks, legal services, and market infrastructures make it uniquely suited to host the transition from analog mercantilism to digital mercantilism. When the Bank of England, city institutions, global law firms, and market participants gather around tokenization, what is being built is not a populist financial commons. It is a new enclosure system, one capable of wrapping assets, payments, and compliance functions into highly legible, highly governable digital frameworks. One should be very clear about the political theory embedded in this change. The older liberal model at least pretended that law stood above commerce and that government derived legitimacy from public consent. Reflexive law abandons both assumptions in practice. It assumes that complex systems cannot be governed by command, only by adaptive procedures. It assumes that expert managed coordination among regulators, firms, NGOs, and transnational bodies is superior to parliamentary struggle or constitutional adjudication. It therefore gives the commanding heights of society to those best positioned to participate in procedural governance, major institutions, not ordinary citizens. This is why sustainable development and ESG were never merely moral campaigns. They were governance technologies. The point was to relocate authority from explicit legislation to standards, disclosures, audits, frameworks, reporting systems, and transnational councils. Once that infrastructure exists, it can be attached to finance, energy, property, supply chains, digital identity, and eventually tokenized assets. The legal architecture does not need to seize everything directly. It only needs to make participation in economic life contingent on compliance with managed procedures. Mercantilism thrives in exactly that environment because mercantilism is not threatened by proceduralism. It feeds on it. The more governance becomes complex, transnational, and data-driven, the more advantage flows to large actors with legal departments, compliance teams, lobbying access, and privileged relationships with regulators, small competitors, local communities, and politically unconnected citizens are pushed outward. They face rule systems they cannot negotiate and technical standards they did not help write. That is how monopoly reappears without calling itself monopoly. Erdman's historical contribution is to remind readers that this pattern is old. The governing families, the extractive mechanisms, and the legitimating ideologies persist across centuries, even when the institutional forms evolve. The East India Company had a charter, a flag, and canon. The modern system has sandboxes, stablecoins, ESG frameworks, and distributed ledgers. But the functional resemblance is too strong to ignore. In both cases, privileged private actors operate inside state-protected legal arrangements that expand commercial control while claiming to serve a civilizational mission. The mission statement has changed from spreading empire to saving the planet, modernizing finance, or democratizing access. That rhetorical shift is significant, but it should not distract from the mechanics. Mercantilism has always required an ideology noble enough to mask extraction. Today, reflexive law provides the legal script through which that ideology is operationalized. It converts aspirations into procedures, procedures into standards, standards into market permissions, and market permissions into durable institutional power. Seen in that light, the current enthusiasm for tokenized real-world assets, programmable payments, and blockchain settlement is not a break with history. It is the continuation of a very old story. Assets are being translated into digital claims that can be monitored, partitioned, pledged, and exchanged with unprecedented granularity. Payments are being drawn into infrastructures designed for conditionality, traceability, and integrated supervision. Financial law is being softened into experimental governance so that these transformations can proceed under the banner of innovation. The legal bloodstream carrying all of this is reflexive rather than substantive. That is why identifying reflexive law as the legal system of technocracy was not only defensible, but necessary. It named the jurisprudential form of a broader civilizational shift. Without that term, many observers could see the rise of stakeholder capitalism, ESG, transnational governance, and programmable finance, but could not explain why these developments so often bypassed democratic accountability while retaining the aura of legality. Reflexive law explains the bypass. It shows how law can be used to hollow out law, how process can replace principle, and how regulation can become the method by which power immunizes itself from political challenge. It also clarifies why the City of London remains so pivotal. The city is not simply a financial center, among others. It is a historical node where mercantile privilege, offshore legal engineering, monetary innovation, and political exceptionalism have long converged. In the age of blockchain finance, that legacy does not disappear. It mutates. The same jurisdictional genius that once managed Eurodollars and offshore entities can now help manage tokenized securities, digital collateral, and regulated stablecoin ecosystems. Reflexive law supplies the adaptive legal machinery. The city supplies the institutional habitat. The result is an emerging order in which mercantilism no longer needs explicit imperial language. It can operate through sustainability mandates, innovation sandboxes, public-private councils, and distributed ledgers. It can claim transparency while concentrating control. It can promise access while enclosing participation. It can praise decentralization while consolidating governance in the hands of approved nodes and approved issuers. This is mercantilism rendered elegant, digitized, and morally laundered. For that reason, the original identification stands stronger than ever. Reflexive law is the legal operating system of technocracy because it enables managerial control without admitting sovereignty, coercion without explicit command, and social transformation without democratic consent. It also functions as the modern legal grammar of mercantilism because it lets privileged commercial actors write and inhabit the procedures through which wealth, rights, and assets are organized. Martin Erdman's historical work helps reveal the continuity. The City of London demonstrates the institutional persistence. Blockchain ledgers and tokenization reveal the next theater of deployment. What lies ahead, then, is not merely a legal debate, but a civilizational one. If substantive law continues to yield to reflexive frameworks, and if reflexive frameworks continue to be fused with digital finance, then the future of property, payment, and economic participation will be governed less by public law than by institutional protocol. That is the endpoint toward which technocracy has always inclined. You will own nothing and be happy. See my just-released book, The New Economics of Technocracy. You will own nothing. Shame on the legal community, lawyers, judges, and academia for ignoring reflexive law in the first place and letting it poison the legal system in America. Please share this article and audio file.